My name is Christian Ashley, a seminary student and servant of God, and you are listening to the Let Nothing Move You podcast, a proud Anazal Ministries podcast.
Welcome back, everyone, to the next episode of the Let Nothing Move You podcast. I'm your host, Christian Ashley, as we continue on through the book of Joshua. Today, we're going to be in Joshua 13 through 17, getting through a lot of lists and a lot of proper nouns and a lot of important things that are going to be discussed here. Surprisingly more than you'd expect. Just a little bit of housekeeping first. By the time you're listening to this, I will have come back from the winter retreat that we're doing with the students at Real Life Church. Just thank you for your prayers and everything. You know, hopefully everyone came back alive, no hospital visits, nothing bad happened. But you can continue to be praying for me as that as I'm coming back there. Depending on the day, I may be on the road at this moment in time, maybe a day after that, kind of depends. Where I'm going with my grandmother and father, you know, to a vacation together, just get a little time away from everything, hang out and have fun in the mountains of Tennessee. So just prayers for that to be done well. So yeah, moving on, let's go ahead and get into this one. We're going to be starting in chapter 13 in verses 1 through 7. Now Joshua was old and advanced in years, and the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years, and there remains yet very much land to possess. This is the land that yet remains. All the regions of the Philistines and all those of the Geshurites from the Shihor, which is east of Egypt, northward to the boundary of Ekron, it is counted as Canaanite. There are five rulers of the Philistines, those of Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron, and those of the Avim. In the south, all the land of the Canaanites and Meara that belongs to the Sidonians, to Aphek, to the boundary of the Amorites, and the land of the Gebelites, and all Lebanon, toward the sunrise from Baal-Gad, below Mount Hermon to Lebo Hamath. All the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon to Misrephoth-Maim, even all the Sidonians. I myself will drive them out from before the people of Israel. Only allot the land to Israel for an inheritance, as I have commanded you. Now therefore divide this land for an inheritance to the nine tribes and half the tribe of Manasseh." This is the start of many chapters in Joshua where we stop the war narrative. To an extent, it pops up every now and then, and we go instead into the allotment of the land and what Israel is supposed to do as a nation when the war isn't finished yet. And look, I know some of you out there are looking to these chapters and you're saying, "I don't get it, Christian. I don't see the purpose of these. This is just a bunch of names, a list of locations. Like, what does this mean to me?" Well, I'll get there because there's surprisingly a lot of it. And I say this as someone I've read this multiple times over. But actually pouring into this and actually thinking a little more critically than I normally would just reading through everything has forced me to recognize a lot of this, that there's so much of how we as people react to when we've been given something by God. We'll get to that in a second. But the first part we need to hit here is, I would argue, one of the greatest parts of Joshua that doesn't get too much focus on. And that, of course, being is that he's their leader. He's in charge, but there is no successor plan. Go all the way back to the Pentateuch. Moses was building up Joshua to replace him as a leader. And it hasn't happened yet. And why is that important? Well, because as God has noted here, Joshua is old and advanced in years. Our leaders age, and we need to prepare for that. If I ever end up at a church somewhere in a position of a head pastor role, what have you, I'm not like, "Hey, I'm about to die." I need to know that if something were to happen to me, or if I were to leave and go elsewhere, there would be someone who can take care of that church in my stead. Maybe not as the leader, but as someone who can take charge until they find a leader. But that doesn't happen in Joshua. And mind-bogglingly, it's not really mentioned that much as to, or at all, really, why he didn't do what Moses did for him. There's no thing where we get some private revelation from him and God, where God tells him, "I don't want Israel to have a next leader. I don't want there to be a centralized force anymore. I want them to depend on me wholly." Or Joshua not even thinking about it, which I would argue is very out of character for him. Simply put, we don't know. And that is frustrating. As someone who loves understanding things, as someone who loves having as much knowledge as possible, for whatever reason, God decided he didn't want that written down. That's just something he and I are going to have to take up when it's nighttime before the throne. There'll be many other things that are far more important, but I'm going to have the question. And what we have here is God acknowledging this and pointing it out to Joshua. And maybe there's some part of him who goes, "Maybe I should have prepared more or something. Maybe he thinks Caleb's going to be the guy next because he's a little younger than Joshua." Who knows? It's not really brought up, but what it does show us is that we need to learn from this. Hey, we need to learn from Scripture. What is Scripture telling us today? Our leaders age, and we need to prepare for that. So how do we do this? Well, a good leader should know that he has capable men in the church under him who are just as capable in other places, or maybe even better than the leader, at taking control, taking charge, and making sure that people are cared for. That's why if your church is able to, you should be able to have an associate pastor. You should be able to have a youth pastor, a worship pastor. The men of the church should be in those roles there as God has commanded. If you're able to do that. If you're not, there should still be people in the church that the pastor is equipping to be able to teach when he's not there, or, you know, that have gifts of their own. They're able to go to the Sunday school or something like that, Bible study, what have you, to teach the people of the Lord, so that, God forbid, pastor gets sick or dead or something else. Like, there is someone there to replace him so the church is still able to function. Because we do not live in a hierarchical system, gosh, that word, where there is an absolute authority figure who has say over every single thing. That is not how the Protestant church works. And for good reason, because that's a stupid way to live with human beings. Human beings are frail. Human beings are weak. We make mistakes. Even the greatest leaders of the church have sinned because they're human beings. We don't put all of our eggs in one basket there, but there still should be enough of authority for that leader to say how things are supposed to be done, to get things done, to work together with the people in the church to make things are done correctly, and to have people prepared to take over if they can't be there, to make decisions when they can't be there. So God is pointing this and a lot more out to Joshua here to say, look, your time is almost up, buddy. Use it wisely, because the work's not done. Like, this allotment of the land here isn't because Israel totally conquered Canaan. No, it's because they haven't, but they need to know where they should be focusing their forces at so they could conquer all of Canaan. But the good news is that even though the work isn't done, God gave them time to rest. That doesn't mean the war is over. It doesn't mean that this is all they should ever expect to be given. But no, like, look, I've given you a lot. If you actually look at a map here, it's a shame we can't do this in an audio-only format to show how much Israel conquered. Like, man, that's pretty impressive. It's not everything, but it's more than half. They've got plenty for right now, and they're going to get more if they had done what they were supposed to do. Now, later God will give them that under the leadership of David and Solomon. But, you know, that's its own thing. But right here and now, even though the work isn't done, God has given Israel time to rest. And the same is true of his church. Look, working in churches sometimes is the most stressful place in the world you can be, because there is a lot of work to be done. I don't know if you know this about the world, but it's a screwed up place where there's a lot of wrong going on. There's a lot of bad things that are happening out there. There's a reason the church exists. It's because the world needs the church just as much as we need God. And the church needs to be working with God so they are actually working for the kingdom instead of working for self. But that can get so, so very tiring. So God gives his people rest. You know, Sunday is a time of work, but it's also a time of Sabbath. It's a time to get away. You know, for leadership especially, not just leadership, you know, AV team, greeters, small group leaders, children's ministers, so on and so forth. It's work, but it's work that's meant to give people rest so that they can find another rest later on. Like one of the pastors, you know, I work with, one of my mentors, he would take Fridays off for himself because Sunday wasn't a day of rest. Like, it was a day of work. It was a day of work, once again, to inspire rest in others and give them rest. But for him, it wasn't rest because he had to work. So he had to find a way. Where do I find my rest? Well, Fridays. Unless there's an absolute emergency, that's my day off. I'm not doing anything, because he needed rest. Otherwise, he would grow belligerent. Otherwise, he would grow cranky, resentful, spiteful, hateful of the people he's supposed to be serving. And that's a terrible place to be in as a leader. It's a terrible place to be in as a church. If the church is restless, the church isn't doing its job as well as it could. But God, knowing us, had gave us that day of rest, but also told us, hey, every now and then, take a break beyond what I told you to do, because you need it. You need time to recharge. You need time to get your act together. You need time to spend time with me, because ironically, working a church can take you away from God if you're not careful. But it also doesn't mean losing sight of everything else. It means for a time, I'm taking rest. For a time right here in history, Israel is taking rest so that they can go and work, not so they can go off and slack off. No, so they can go off and work. That's why God, knowing his people well, challenged them through both work and rest. And another thing that's brought up here is that there is a personal responsibility to us for doing God's work. Specifically to the different tribes here, God breaks them up as he does. Says, all right, I'm giving you this land here, this city here, this sphere of influence here. You're the ones who are going to have to take it. I'm with you, don't get me wrong, but you have to get up off your butts and get the work done, Israel. Just in the same way he looks to us, the church, and says, look, I've given you the victory, but you got to grasp it. You've got to run for it. You've got to seize it. Otherwise, you're going to miss it. So there is a personal responsibility to every single one of us in the church to do his work. And that's different from you than it is from me in many regards. Sometimes we're going to be doing the exact same thing. But other times, what he tells you to do is going to be very different from what he tells me to do. And we have to assist each other in that so we don't spiral out. So we don't get tired. So we don't stop loving God. And that's difficult. But it's well worth doing. And what we're going to see here in Joshua and Judges and parts of, I mean, the rest of the historical books, really, is what happens when Israel takes the risk part, but it doesn't take the work part. It doesn't take the action step of loving God well, of serving him well, because, well, they like being comfortable. They like not, you know, having to worry about this. They like whatever makes them feel good. That's really the history of Israel. It's really the history of us. When you actually pay attention to the historical narrative of the Bible, you're going to see exactly that. God preserves them. God keeps them safe. Israel says, thanks, God. We love you, God. Let's worship you. Israel stops worshiping as much. They get a little tired. They get a little resentful. They go, oh, we can do whatever we want. And God says, all right, you can't be doing that. Punishes them. They come back to God. He punishes them after they fail again. They come back to God. It's an endless cycle because that's who we are as people. There's never been a perfect people group in history. There's never been a perfect church in history because that church, that people group has sinners in its midst. Every last one of them. It has human beings in its midst. Every last one of them. And human beings are imperfect and flawed. That's not something I say because I hate human beings. That's not something I say because I have no hope for human beings. It's because I'm honest about who we are. I'm honest about who I am. I'm a screw up. Yeah, I've done great things with God's help. Yes, I serve him. Yes, I love him. But if I'm not careful, I can end up back in places I don't need to be. The same is true of every single one of us who serves him. Let's get our minds right in that regard. Let's also go forward by going through verses 8 through 14. With the other half of the tribe of Manasseh, the Reubenites and the Gadites received their inheritance, which Moses gave them beyond the Jordan eastward, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them. From Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of Arnon, and a city that is in the middle of the valley, and all the tableland of Medeba, as far as Dibon, and all the cities of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, as far as the boundary of the Ammonites, and Gilead, and the region of the Geshurites and Maacathites, and all Mount Hermon, and all Bashan, the Salika, all the kingdom of Og and Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth and in Edrei, he alone was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. These Moses had struck and driven out. Yet the people of Israel did not drive out the Geshurites or the Maacathites, but Geshur and Maacath dwell in the midst of Israel to this day. To the tribe of Levi alone, Moses gave no inheritance. The offerings by fire to the Lord God of Israel are their inheritance, as he said to them. So if you remember from our time in the Pentateuch, when Moses and Israel had conquered that land on the other side of the Jordan that God had not originally promised him, and yet God gave them anyway, the people of Israel, you know, two and a half of these tribes, you recognize, oh, well, these are good spots. Like, why don't we just settle here? And the fear was is that they wouldn't join their fellow brethren attacking the land that God had promised them. And they had made the deal with Moses, like, look, if you'll give us this land, we'll keep doing what we're doing. And God was okay with it. And they made a deal. And now the time is to make good on that deal. It's been many years that they've been serving in the land. These lands need to be cultivated. Wives and children need to be looked after. You know, flocks need to be tended to. Fields need to be tended to. So go off and do that. Even though the entire land isn't done, has been fully conquered, you still need to go back home. Now, it doesn't mean your personal responsibility is gone. You will never assist your fellow Israelites in conquering the land. That's exactly what they do. This is what you're supposed to do. Take a time of rest. You even have problems in your own side of things you need to be taken care of. Those Geshurites, the Maacathites, they're still there. Now, they are not Canaanites, the Geshurites and Maacathites. That's why they are not originally wiped out. But they are still in land that is possessed by Israel. And they have allied with the Canaanites in their culture, in how they do things, and in them causing problems with Israel, and that they are introducing them to gods they should not be worshiping. Therefore, they need to be destroyed. How do I know that? Well, they're not God's people. You know what not God's people do? Not serve God. So if they're going to dwell in the lands of Israel, they either need to convert or they need to be gotten rid of, as we said earlier. Now, that sounds cruel. That sounds harsh. But I don't know what book you've been reading, because God has laid up everything he needs to tell you about why it's a bad thing to have evil people in your midst like this when your goal is to serve God and they refuse to repent. And once again, Old New Testament, same God, by the way, same God, didn't change at all. But how he approached his people changed. How he approached the world is, I wouldn't even say changed. I would say brought to a better understanding, because at this point in time, there is no salvation. There is no Jesus for them to understand. So it makes no sense to them why they should have to move over this way. But as we'll see, they fail to do this, these 2.5 tribes. But knowing they were going to fail, God still gave them the opportunity to either, you know, do what he told them to do or to fail, which is what he knew was going to happen. But at the end of the day, God used the Geshurites and Maacathites to test Israel. David, later on, when he's in the midst of his wanderings, working with the Philistines, pretending to attack Israelite cities, he's going to attack the land around here, sack them, as, you know, their ancestors should have done years ago. Also, as well, he's going to marry into them, because once again, they're not Canaanites, so he is under no obligation not to be able to do this, and is going to produce a son. Now, of course, if I remember correctly, is Absalom, and that's going to cause his own problems, but that's more David's fault than anyone else. Also, here we see something we already knew, if you've once again been following with us, that the tribe of Levi is to have no inheritance in the land. Why? Because they need to serve everyone in the land equally. They are going to be dispersed across all the 12 tribes, becoming this like 13th tribe, as it were, in the midst of the 12 tribes. That's why it says 12 tribes of Israel. What that's really saying is it puts Joseph together, Ephraim and Manasseh as one. It's its own thing. We've talked about it before. But the tribe of Levi is to devote themselves to serving God and serving the people. As such, they have no land of their own as far as possessing it, but they are still given places to live. But ultimately, they're not to put down roots in the same way the other tribes of Israel are to do, because they're not supposed to have possessions. They're supposed to focus solely on the people of God and serving him. Let's go from there to verses 15 through 33. And Moses gave an inheritance to the tribe of the people of Reuben according to their clans. So the territory was from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, and a city that is in the middle of the valley, and all the tableland by Medeba, with Heshbon and all its cities that are in the tableland, Dibon and Bamoth Baal, and Beth Baal Meon, and Jahaz, and Kedemoth, and Mephath, and Kiriathaim, and Sibma, and Zereth Shahar on the hill of the valley, and Beth Peor on the slopes of Pisgah, and Beth Jeshimoth, that is, all the cities of the tableland, and all the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, whom Moses defeated with the leaders of Midian, Evi and Rechem, and Zur, and Hur, and Reba, the princes of Sihon who lived in the land. Balaam, also the son of Beor, the one who practiced divination, was killed with the sword by the people of Israel, among the rest of their slain. And a border of the people of Reuben was the Jordan as a boundary. This was the inheritance of the people of Reuben according to their clans for their cities and villages. Moses gave an inheritance also to the tribe of Gad, to the people of Gad according to their clans. Their territory was Jazer and all the cities of Gilead, and half of the Ammonites to Aroer, which is east of Rabbah, and from Heshbon to Ramoth Mizpah and Betonim, and from Mahanaim to the territory of Debir, and the valley of Beth Haram, Beth Nimrah, Succoth, and Zaphon, the rest of the kingdom of Sihon, king of Heshbon, having the Jordan as a boundary, to the lower end of the sea of Kinnereth, eastward beyond the Jordan. This is the inheritance of the people of Gad according to their clans, with their cities and villages. And Moses gave an inheritance to the half-tribe of Manasseh. It was allotted to the half-tribe of the people of Manasseh according to their clans. Their region extended from Mahanaim through all Bashan, the whole kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, and all the towns of Jair, which are in Bashan, 60 cities, and half Gilead and Ashtaroth and Edrei, the cities of the kingdom of Og and Bashan. These were allotted to the people of Machir, the son of Manasseh, for the half of the people of Machir according to their clans. These are the inheritances that Moses distributed in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan, east of Jericho. But to the tribe of Levi, Moses gave no inheritance. The Lord God of Israel is their inheritance, just as he said to them. We'll see something here that's brought up in other chapters that I'm not going to bring up there, but like right here, understand this is happening every single one of these tribes. And that these lands right here, they're all being divided according to family lines in order for that spot to remain within the family throughout the generations of Israel's life as a country, and to prevent other tribes or people from within the tribe from growing greedy and taking what wasn't theirs to own. Going back to the Pentateuch, we see like God is saying, look, when I give you the land, I'm going to give you, based on your family allotment, this space here, you're to develop it as I tell you to, you know, to make yourselves rich in that way, to give offerings to me, so that you all have this and it stays within your family. So that, you know, when you had the time of Jubilee, even if something were to be, you know, sold away for a bit because they were in debt, it would be brought back to that family line. Therefore, take care of it well. Look after it well. Don't sell what isn't yours to give. What I give you is what I have given you as your ultimate landlord and authority. You have no right to give this away to anyone else permanently. It is mine to give to you and give back to you if you were to lose it. So the idea being is that each family was tasked to govern their land well, to look over the fields well, their children well, the families well, in the spirit of trusting God, since they were always reliant on him for the harvest, for their monetary concerns, for their sacrifices. That way they didn't have to depend on anyone else. That was the ideal. Unfortunately, ideals are very hardly realized in this world because people corrupt them. You would have many parts in Israeli history where they would take land that wasn't theirs, sell it off because the family was in debt, and never give it back to them because there was no year of Jubilee, as was supposed to be practiced. Other times you'd have foreign people come in and take over land that wasn't theirs, and wouldn't be given back to the people. The idea being is that Israel lost its way. Imagine that. But where they're starting off is good, because the intention, the ideal, is that they trust in God to watch over their land. It is not God's fault that his people ruin what he designs. It is the fault of the people, not God. And we also see here that God had blessed, you know, Joseph way back when we discussed him in Genesis. He'd been blessing him the entire time, but he blesses him even more. And that he has two sons, but not only that, they are considered to be two separate tribes, one of which was so large that they needed an extra inheritance. God, as far as I'm remembering, doesn't promise this to Joseph. And yet, what does God do? Go beyond what he promises, gives in abundance. And this is supposed to be assigned to Israel, supposed to be assigned to these tribes here. Look, I'm giving you what you haven't earned, what you haven't deserved, what is mine to give you, because this is my inheritance to give you. Because I promised this to your father Abraham. The Canaanites, they're not the real leaders here. They're not the real owners here. They're a bunch of squatters. They're a bunch of losers who had no right to this land. I let them live here, don't get me wrong. But because they didn't repent, because they didn't follow after me, it's yours. Because it was already yours to begin with. Let me give you what I promised you and more. Let me increase the bounty of your fields. Let me increase the numbers of your family line. Just trust me. And the sad fact of the matter is, this is not what happens. The people rebel. The people don't listen. When all they had to do was just do what God told them to do. That's easy enough to say, yes. And I'm guilty of that most days of my life. And yet, the simplicity of it all is something we should look at here when it comes to them and when it comes to us. How easy is it to just give up everything to God? Well, depending on how resistant you are to it, not too easy. Or if you know better, it should be extremely easy. And yet we're going to see time and time again in their lives and our own lives, all we have to do is surrender. All we have to do is do what we're told to do. And when we don't, we're suddenly shocked. Oh, why did this happen? Why did these bad things happen to me? Like, Lord, why? And he's like, really? Don't you remember what you said you'd do? Don't you remember what I said I'd do to you if you did do this or you didn't do this? Don't keep complaining to me. You know better. So keep all that in mind as we're going through the next couple chapters here, and as well as we get into the book of Judges. Like, there's a reason judges aren't needed to be brought up in Israel, because Israel needs judging. But that's for the future. For right now, let's go to chapter 14, verses 1 through 5. These are the inheritances that the people of Israel received in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the people of Israel gave them to inherit. Their inheritance was by lot, just as the Lord had commanded by the hand of Moses for the 9 1/2 tribes. For Moses had given an inheritance to the 2 1/2 tribes beyond the Jordan, but to the Levites he gave no inheritance among them. For the people of Joseph were two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, and no portion was given to the Levites in the land, but only cities to dwell in with their pasture lands for their livestock and their sustenance. The people of Israel did as the Lord commanded Moses, they allotted the land. And here we get a very important distinction. I mentioned it earlier, but this is not Israel's conquest that wins them today. It is God giving them an inheritance. Yes, Israel was in a war with the Canaanites. Yes, Israel conquered the land, but that didn't justify them taking the land. What justified them taking the land is that it was theirs and God had given it to them an inheritance, because God is the ultimate authority of who lives where and who lives where. And who is supposed to be in charge of a land. Sorry, I repeated myself. The Canaanites, once again, they're a bunch of squatters, essentially. This isn't their land. God allowed them to live there. Don't get me wrong. But what did they do with what God allowed them to do? They took advantage of him. They took advantage of the land that he gave them, and they dared to profane it with their terrible rituals, with the evil they committed, with their unrepentance. So they have no right to tell God, we don't deserve to be uprooted from this land. This is ours. No, it's not. He gave it to them for a time, but it was also his to take away because of unfaithfulness, just as he'll do to Israel, by the way. So don't think, oh, this is just God showing favoritism, but no, he's going to do the exact same thing to Israel multiple times over in their history. And it's by his grace alone that they're able to have a land right now after 1947. They didn't earn it. They didn't do anything to deserve it. And yet God gave it to them anyway, because he loves them. Anyone who tells you otherwise does not know God as well as they think they do. That's their land. Not through conquest, not because they're some special race, but because God has a special relationship to them. And also because it's theirs, because he said so. And if anyone gets to pull the card because I said so, it's him. Another thing we see here is that God gave land by lot to show that he was in control of which territory Israel inherited and which family would get what he desired them to have. The idea behind this is this was to prevent human conflict from erupting over human-based decision-making. They could say, well, Joshua, you like this. You're from Ephraim, man. You like them more. So that's why you're giving them more. We deserve more. Or I can say, well, we weren't properly represented, you know, Gad or Issachar or whoever. We deserve more. We deserve as much as Judah gets. Instead, anyone who disagreed wasn't disagreeing with human decisions, but with God's. And we're going to see in these chapters that this exact same thing happens, but it's going to reveal the nature of the people behind the ones making those statements, because they're going to make excuses for their own issues. But it's not God's fault that they can't do what they're told to do. But one good thing we do get for this point in time in history is that Israel did as God commanded. And that's something to be commended. Yeah, it can be very easy to get very caustic, very uppity about Israel not following God, as we've seen throughout the entire Pentateuch, as we're seeing now, as we'll see through the historical books of the Bible and more. But when they do the right thing, you know what we should do? Gold star. You did what you were supposed to be doing. Let me call you out as an example. That's how we're supposed to be, because we just accentuate the negative too much for our own good. And then we start demonizing people who don't need to be demonized. And it has no place in the church. If we're actually going to study history correctly, that means we praise the good and we despise the evil. So let me right now praise the good, because there's going to be a lot of despising the evil coming up. Not in these next couple of verses, but in a couple after. Let's continue there to verses 6 through 15. Then the people of Judah came to Joshua of Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, you know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, in Kadesh Barnea, concerning you and me? It was 40 years ago when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought him word again as it was in my heart. By my brothers who went up with me, may the heart of the people melt, yet I wholly follow the Lord my God. And Moses swore that day, saying, sure that the land on which your foot has trodden shall be an inheritance for you and your children forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord your God. And now behold, the Lord has kept me alive, just as he said, these 45 years since the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses. Well, Israel walked in the wilderness, and now behold, I am this day 85 years old. I am still as strong today as I was in the age that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then, for war and for going and for coming. So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day, for you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out just as the Lord said. Then Joshua blessed him, and he gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, for an inheritance. Therefore Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord, the God of Israel. Then the name of Hebron was formerly was Kiriath Arba. Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim, and the land had rest from war. Now, if you've been following along with this, you know Caleb. He hasn't shown up too many times, but he's been there in the Pentateuch. And he's showing up again here in Joshua as one of only two, the other, of course, being Joshua, spies, who did exactly what they were supposed to do, spied out the land and had faithfulness to God and reported back how, yeah, they may be big, they may be strong, they may have these fortified cities, they may be taller than us, but you know what? We've got God. What are you guys worried about? Let's take them. And when the other spies caused discord, melted Israel's heart, God preserved Joshua and Caleb, so that they could lead Israel. They could be examples. Look, I am living proof of what happens when you serve God. And here is a further bit of that. He has earned his inheritance because of his faithfulness. He was committed as a spy and leader, and second, by denying evil and continuing to grow his people in faith to support God. Now, God, seeing this, rewarded him beyond what the others get because he wished to show his love for Caleb's faithfulness. Look at what I will give you if you serve me, not in a prosperity gospel sense, but because I love you and because you have earned this, let me give it to you on my timing, not because you pray for it, not because you just want it. It is mine to give you when I choose to do so. And to further rub it in, what does he do? Caleb doesn't have the place that he's asking for yet. It still has to be conquered. So to further show the Israelites, this is how things are supposed to be done, what does he do? Gathers them together to fight against what they're already supposed to be fighting against, but also with the added incentive, this is the land I'm going to own. These other places that you're going to settle in, good for you. But for me, I'm going to take what's mine. And I want you to do the rest with me when it's your time to do it. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to take the land of the people you guys were so afraid of. These giants, these Anakim. You think I'm afraid of them? No, because I serve God. I'm going to take their land. You know what Caleb does? He takes that land. He defeats their enemies to show that it doesn't matter who they are and what they're about. What matters is who we are and what we're about. You either serve God or you despise God. Caleb served God and God rewarded him for it. And as well, he gets Joshua to give Caleb a blessing because Joshua recognizes that Caleb is a fellow leader and faithful supporter of God and lets him do the work. Good leaders of churches should encourage other leaders of good churches to get the work done. We're not isolated pockets of resistance here. We work in a greater group. We work with other churches to get things done when those churches are doing the correct thing. There are churches out there that know nothing of God and pretend that they do, and we have no business with them. But for those who are actually getting the work done, follow them, seek them, get the work done. And an important part we need to discuss here too is at the very end, and the land had rest from war. Does that mean the war is over? Does God say the conquest is over there? No. Once again, there was rest in the land, but it was not peace. The goal of total inheritance had not occurred yet. Yet God was faithful enough to Israel to give them time for rest, knowing what they would do with that rest, because he loves them more than they love him. And if that's not the story of our lives, I don't know what else is. We've got more to cover today, so we're going to go through chapter 15, 1 through 19. The allotment for the tribe of the people of Judah, according to their clans, reached southward to the boundary of Edom, to the wilderness of Zin at the farthest south, and the south boundary ran from the east, into the Salt Sea, from the bay that faces southward. It goes out southward of the ascent of Akrabim. Oh boy, more proper nouns. Passes along to Zin and goes up south of Kadesh Barnea, along by Hezron, up to Adar, turns about to Karka, passes along to Asmon, goes out by the brook of Egypt, and comes to its end at the sea. This shall be your south boundary. And the east boundary is the Salt Sea to the mouth of the Jordan, and the boundary of the north side runs from the bay of the sea at the mouth of the Jordan, and the boundary goes up to Beth Hogla and passes along north of Beth Araba, and the boundary goes up to the stone of Bohan, the son of Reuben. And the boundary goes up to Debir from the valley of Achor, and so northward, turning toward Gilgal, which is opposite the ascent of Adumim, which is on the south side of the valley. And the boundary passes along to the waters of En-Shemesh and ends at En-Rogel. Then the boundary goes up to the valley of the son of Hemon at the southern shoulder of the Jebusite that is Jerusalem. And the boundary goes up to the top of the mountain that lies over against the valley of Hemon. On the west, at the northern end of the valley of Rephaim. Then the boundary extends from the top of the mountain to the spring of the waters of Nephtoah, and from there to the cities of Mount Ephron. Then the boundary bends back to Bala, that is Kiriath Jearim. And the boundary circles west of Bala to Mount Seir, passes along to the northern shoulder of Mount Jearim, that is Cheshalon, and goes down to Beth Shemesh, and passes along by Timnah. The boundary goes out to the shoulder of the hill north of Ekron, then the boundary bends to the around to Shikaron, and passes along to Mount Bala and goes out to Jabneel. Then the boundary comes to an end at the sea, and the west boundary was the Great Sea with its coastline. This is the boundary around the people of Judah according to their clans. According to the commandment of the Lord to Joshua, he gave Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, a portion among the people of Judah, Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron. Arba was the father of Anak. And Caleb drove out from there the three sons of Anak, Sheshai and Ahiman and Talmai, the descendants of Anak. And he went up from there against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, whoever strikes Kiriath Sefer and captures it, to him I will give Aksa, my daughter, as wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, captured it. And he gave him Aksa, his daughter, as wife. When she came to him, she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she got off her donkey, and Caleb said to her, what do you want? She said to him, give me a blessing. Since you have given me the land of the Negev, give me also the springs of water. And he gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. Guys, I promise it's only going to get worse with the proper nouns. This is not meant for a man with a lisp and a stutter that I actively have to fight against every time I talk. But we're going to get through it, I swear. Let's get to Judah. Judah, if you were to look at a map at these regions that are brought up here, is surrounded by enemies on almost every single side when they receive their allotment. This is a daunting task, but a task God knew that if they had actually gotten their act together, it could have gotten done. Because they were a very powerful and numerous tribe, they had the ability to do this. But even more, if they'd have faith in him, they could have gotten it done. Now, history will show that they failed at this time to do so, not because of the strength of their enemies, but because of their weak and faithless hearts. Yet despite this, God still preserved them as he promised to. That's something important to glean from there, and that God knows they're going to fail, and yet despite that, preserves them because they are his people. None of my Bible scholars out there, 13 through 19 is going to sound fairly familiar. Well, that's because we're going to get more of that in the book of Judges. The tale of Othniel is going to be retold, expanded upon there. We're going to see the oppression of Israel by the Canaanites after they failed to conquer the land fully. But more importantly, what we see here is Caleb using his role as a leader to embolden the next generation to act wisely and courageously to fight for God and their people. So too does this embolden his daughter Achsah to be brave enough to ask for more of an inheritance that would fit her new family. Hey, you conquered a city, but if we're going to need fields for everything, we're going to need water for our livestock and everything, and for ourselves, give me this too. This is something done not for the sake of greed, but for the sake of foresight. This is a smart woman. She's marrying into a new family and wants to preserve her family even more. So she goes up to her dad, says, look, we've won. Also give me this because she's put some forethought into it. She's not an idiot. She has thought through this. That is something we could all learn. You don't see the name of Achsah brought up too much in your Bible learning. But you know what? We should be paying more attention to her because this is one smart gal. One of the greatest catches you could argue in the history of marriage. At that point in time, you would think Othniel is the winner here. He definitely is, but not as much as it seems to be the fact that he's gained a wife that is a real spitfire, one who's taking care of her new family. But we've got more to get through, my friends. And that, of course, leads us to verses 20 through 63, so bear with me. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the people of Judah according to their clans. The cities belonging to the tribe of the people of Judah in the extreme south toward the boundary of Edom were Kabzeel, Eder, Jager, Kena, Damona, Adada, Kadesh, Hazor. I can't be laughing this early. I have more to go. Hazor, Ithnan, Ziph, Telem, Bealoth, Hazor, Hadatha, Kiriath, Hezron, that is Hazor, Amam, Shema, Molada, Hazar Gada, Heshmon, Beth Pelet, Hazar Shual, Beersheba, Vithiothia, Bala, Eim, Izim, Eltolad, Chisel, Horma, Ziklag, Madmana, Sansana, Labaoth, Bilhaim, Ain, and Rimon, in all 29 cities with their villages. And in the lowland, Eshtoel, Zora, Ashna, Zanoa, Inganim, Tapua, Enam, Jarmuth, Adullam, Soka, Akaza, Sharaim, Adithaim, Gedera, Gederothaim, 14 cities with their villages. Zanan, Hadasha, Midgal, Gad, Delian, Mizpah, Drakthiel, Lachish, Bozkath, Eglon, Eglon, Kavan, Lamam, Chitlish, Gederoth, Beth Dagon, Nama, and Makeda, 16 cities with their villages. Libna, Ether, Ashan, Iftah, Ashna, Nazib, Kela, Akzib and Marisha, 9 cities with their villages. Ekron with his towns and its villages, from Ekron to the sea, all that were by the side of Ashdod with their villages. Ashdod, its towns and its villages, Gaza, its towns and its villages, to the brook of Egypt and the great sea with its coastline. And in the hill country, Shamir, Jatir, Soka, Dana, Kiryasana, that is Debir, Anab, Eshtamal, Anim, Goshen, Holon, and Gilo, 11 cities with their villages. Arab, Duma, Ishan, Janim, Beth Tapua, Afaka, Hamta, Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, and Zior, 9 cities with their villages. Maon, Carmel, Ziph, Juta, Jezreel, Joktaim, Zanoa, Cain, Gibeah, and Timnah, 10 cities with their villages. Halhul, Bezur, Gedor, Marath, Bethanath, and Elkatan, 6 cities with their villages. Kiriath Baal, that is Kiriath Jearim, and Rabbah, 2 cities with their villages. In the wilderness, Beth Araba, Midden, Sekaka, Nibshan, the city of salt, and Engedi, 6 cities with their villages. But the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the people of Judah could not drive out, so the Jebusites dwell with the people of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. I need like a medal for that. All right, what does all that mean? Well, that's what Judah owns, or should own. Judah, as a prosperous tribe, as a numerous tribe, has been given enough land and more for their needs if they did what they were supposed to do. And yet, as we will see, I mean, just the very end there, just one city is mentioned out of there where the Canaanites aren't driven out, but so much more. The Philistines aren't driven out. Many of the other Canaanites aren't driven out because they didn't have their hearts and minds right, because they weren't following God. And it's not going to be until the time of David that they're able to sack and conquer Jerusalem fully. That, you may know, is hundreds of years after the fact when it should have been right here and now. And it's a sad story we're going to hear time and time again, especially as we continue on, we read all of chapter 16, verses 1 through 10. The allotment of the people of Joseph went from the Jordan by Jericho, east of the waters of Jericho, into the wilderness, going up from Jericho into the hill country to Bethel. Then going from Bethel to Luz, it passes to Atharoth, the territory of the Arkites. Then it goes down westward to the territory of the Jephthahites, as far as the territory of lower Beth Horon, then to Gezer, and it ends at the sea. The people of Joseph, Manasseh, and Ephraim received their inheritance. The territory of the people of Ephraim by their clans was as follows. The boundary of their inheritance on the east was Ataroth Adar, as far as upper Beth Horon, and the north is Mikmethath. Then on the east, the boundary turns around towards Taanach Shiloh and passes along beyond it on the east to Genoa. Then it goes down from Genoa to Ataroth and to Nara and touches Jericho, ending at the Jordan. From Tapua, the boundary goes westward to the brook Kana and ends at the sea. Such is the inheritance of the people of the tribe of Ephraim by their clans, together with the towns that were set apart for the people of Ephraim within the inheritance of the Manassites, all those towns with their villages. However, they did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites have lived in the midst of Ephraim to this day, but have been made to do forced labor. Good old Ephraim. Not as bad as Dan, ultimately, in history, I would argue. But one of the worst tribes overall when it came to serving God. And they were a very powerful tribe, much like their brother Manasseh. But even they, based on their own strength, could not defeat their Canaanite laborers. They became laborers, their neighbors. What did they do with them? Well, they made them laborers. They made them slaves. Which, by the way, slavery of the Canaanites was not what God had in mind. You can argue, well, Christian, they're alive. Isn't that better? No! Have you been paying attention? Do not justify life simply because they get to live. That life is going to cause harm to others. There's a reason the death penalty exists. It's to get people who cannot be in our society gone because they've proven they can't live in it. Israel cannot live beside these people because they cannot live with God. And it's that much easier for Israel to be led astray if they're in their midst. So no, this is an evil action, letting them live, because it showed they didn't have trust in God. They showed it didn't have faith. Instead of pressing their advantage, doing exactly what God told them to do, they compromised with evil. You do not compromise with evil. And they dared abuse God's laws of slavery to do this. And we've covered it before, what this slavery is and what it is not. What it is not is chattel slavery. What it is not is demeaning that person as a person and making them a lower life form. What it is showing the relationship between Israel and God through this action here, that you were to treat them as I treat you. You were to love them as I love you. You were to take care of them as I take care of you. This is not taking care of them. They should not exist. They should be gone so that you can actually live in this land well and resist temptation, resist evil, resist living like the people I told you to get rid of, lest I do the same to you, Israel. And if it sounds like I'm getting heated, it's because I am. I have seen this far too many times. Compromises made with the wrong people. In church, compromise with people we don't even need to ally with because we're already fine. And yet people do it because it creates a false unity. And that has no place within the church. False unity is, by its very nature, disunity. You are ununited when there is evil in your midst. It is all God, nothing of man. It is all truth, nothing of lies. You do not compromise with evil. You do not let it into your midst and say, we agree with you. Or, oh, it's okay, you think that way, as long as you do this. They know. Yeah, there are some things in the church you can have opinions on that are not salvific issues. It's not a salvific issue on how the end times are going to occur. It's not a salvific issue on how the earth was created and how long it took. But there are some things that are. Who Jesus is. If you can't answer that right, you're out of the team. If you can't agree on what salvation is, you're out of the team. You have no place here because you're spreading lies. You're spreading untruths. Evil, which has no place in the church, and especially has no place in Israel here. So let's go forward, getting closer to finishing off this part by going to verses in chapter 17, 1 through 6. Then allotment was made to the people of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph. To Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilead, were allotted Gilead and Bashan because he was a man of war. And allotments were made to the rest of the people of Manasseh by their clans, Abiezer, Helek, Azriel, Shechem, Hefer, and Shemaiah. These were the males, descendants of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, by their clans. Now Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, had no sons, but only daughters. And these are the names of his daughters, Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. They approached Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the leaders and said, "The Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among with our brothers." So according to the mouth of the Lord, he gave them an inheritance among the brothers of their father. Thus there fell to Manasseh 10 portions besides the land of Gilead and Bashan, which is on the other side of the Jordan. Because the daughters of Manasseh received an inheritance along with his sons, the land of Gilead was allotted to the rest of the people of Manasseh. There's a lot of callbacks here in these chapters. So if you haven't been paying attention, like there's very little I can do. Because back in the day, when we discussed the daughters of Zelophehad coming up to Moses, what was the issue? Well, the issue was, is by law, they couldn't inherit anything. And their children couldn't inherit anything. It would be lost to another tribe, you know, whoever they married. And that would disgrace their ancestors, who were supposed to be receiving an allotment based on family. And so what did Moses do? He went to God. God spoke about it. God allowed the situation to happen in the first place, knowing this would happen, and prevented evil from spreading by allowing a momentary crisis to occur so that further crises would not occur. He then offered assurances in the law to accommodate women in need and gave them an inheritance when there is no male heir in the family, showcasing God's love of women. That horrible God who hates women and doesn't care about them. You know, he just wants to take away their rights. He wants to take away their freedoms. He doesn't care about them as people. That same God, well, he did this, almost like he loves his creation. Almost as if you pay attention to what he actually says and what he actually does, you can't have that thrown up against him. Almost like you're in the wrong to say that God doesn't love women or that God favors men above women simply because there are roles that one gender is supposed to do and the other is supposed to do. Foolishness, stupidity, evil. Has no place in the church to contradict him. So in light of all this, Joshua wisely follows in the steps of Moses to make sure that they are looked after years after the decision had been made. I cannot stress that enough. This happened years ago, and yet God brings it up, Joshua brings it up, to protect the people they already agreed to help out because God doesn't forget his people. And we continue seeing how he doesn't forget his people and what they do by finishing off today in verses 7 through 18. The territory of Manasseh reached from Asher to Michmathath, which is east of Shechem. Then the boundary goes along southward to the inhabitants of En-Tappuah. The land of Tappuah belonged to Manasseh, but the town of Tappuah on the border of Manasseh belonged to the people of Ephraim. Then the boundary went down to the brook Kanah. These cities to the south of the brook among the cities of Manasseh belonged to Ephraim. Then the boundary of Manasseh goes on the north side of the brook and ends at the sea. The land to the south being Ephraim's, and that to the north being Manasseh's, with the sea forming its boundary. On the north, Asher is reached, and on the east, Issachar. Also in Issachar and in Asher, Manasseh had Beth Shean and its villages, and Ibleam and its villages, and the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, and the inhabitants of Endor and its villages, and the inhabitants of Tanakh and its villages, and the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. The third is Naphoth. Yet the people of Manasseh could not take possession of those cities, but the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in that land. Now when the people of Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not utterly drive them out. And the people of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, "Why have you given me but one lot and one portion as an inheritance, although I am a numerous people, since all along the Lord has blessed me?" And Joshua said to them, "If you are a numerous people, go up by yourselves to the forest, and there clear ground for yourselves in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you." The people of Joseph said, "The hill country is not enough for us, yet all the Canaanites who dwell in the plain have chariots of iron, both those in Beth Shean and its villages and those in the valley of Jezreel." Then Joshua said to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, "You are a numerous people and have great power. You shall not have one allotment only, but the hill country shall be yours, for though it is a forest, you shall clear it and possess it to its farthest borders. For you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have chariots of iron, and though they are strong." What else is there to say? Manasseh, Ephraim failed to do as God instructed them to, and then forced the situation again to gain more land east and west of the Jordan because they couldn't drive out the Canaanites. They had large numbers, but failed to have a large faith. They even dared by proxy to say that God was unfair on his allotment of the land simply because they weren't faithful enough to conquer what he had promised them. They blamed their problems on God and iron chariots rather than their own shortcomings. And this is their fault solely. God had given them the promise. Every single time God sent his people into battle on his terms, when they were right with him, they won. There would be no defeat. Why would there be? Why would God allow that to happen? It is only when Israel was not following him with their whole hearts that they lost. They had learned nothing from Ai. They had learned nothing from Achan. None of these tribes, if they had removed the evil from their hearts, if they had solely depended upon God, the entire land would have been theirs and the history of the world would have been forever changed. There would have been no Philistines. There would have been no Phoenicians. There would have been no problems of people within their very midst spreading lies to worship idols unless they talk to people outside of their nation. These idols wouldn't have been there. Baal and Asherah and Moloch and all these gods would have been lost to history if they'd just done their job. And yet they didn't. They blame things. They say, God, it's your fault you sent us this way. Did they say that exactly? They say it's God's fault? No, but that's what they mean. Because remember, God's the one who was signed by Lot so that they couldn't argue against a human being at fault. They're saying it's his fault. This is a heart problem. And it's intellectually and spiritually dishonest because they also blame it on iron chariots. Now, what this does imply is that if you remember from last time, when Hazor and its congregation attacked Israel, they had chariots. More than likely, they didn't have iron chariots because I think they probably would have noted that to contrast the two. It's still possible they were made of iron, but you know, using what the text says and using it here, I think they're trying to make a parallel there, especially when you go into Judges. The same argument is thrown out. It was the only reason we lost because they had iron chariots. And there'll be that stupid part of, I use air quotes, biblical scholarship that will say, oh, well, God clearly isn't as strong as he says he is because he couldn't overcome iron chariots, which we'll get there when we get there in Judges. But you know, that's patently untrue because you know who had iron chariots in abundance? Egypt, the nation God stole Israel back from to restore as his own. You don't think they had iron chariots? You think that the Canaanites were technologically superior to them? Quit being stupid. Quit being intellectually dishonest. Look at the text. Look at history. They didn't lose because the Canaanites had iron chariots. They were looking for an excuse because they knew the reason they lost is because they weren't serving God as fully as they should have. And Joshua rightfully challenges them on this. Well, I mean, if you're so great, go ahead and do it. If you're a numerous people, go by yourselves. You don't even need us. Why are you coming back to me? You should have had this. It's in the bag. Oh, it's not because you're numerous. Oh, it's because you don't trust in God. So you think maybe that's why these bad things are happening? Maybe? Yeah, when you admit your fault there? Because a good leader will make someone do that? Make them admit fault when they try and divert it elsewhere? Go, oh, it wasn't really my fault. You know, I couldn't talk to them about Jesus. I mean, they're my boss. Oh, I couldn't talk to them about Jesus. Like, they passed me over for promotion. Or I don't know them. Or, I mean, I couldn't do the right thing at that moment. I mean, there were so many people looking at me. I had to just fit in with everyone else. Excuses. And you know what excuses are to God? Nothing. You think he doesn't know the situation you were in? You don't think he didn't know the situation that Ephraim and Manasseh were in? You don't think he doesn't know the root problem of it all is that they don't trust him? He knows they're lying about this. He knows they're making excuses. Why do we think we're any better? Bring truth to him. Lord, I screwed up because I was weak. Lord, I screwed up because I was afraid, and I need you to give me strength. Make me strong and courageous. What has been the theme of this entire book, and they don't get it? Be strong and courageous. Why? Because I've commanded you. Because I am who I say I am. You either believe me or you don't, Israel. You either believe me or you don't, Christian listening to this. So do we? Are we going to make excuses? I've seen when getting excuses gets done, and the answer is nothing. If anything, it harms my witness. And we can't afford that in a world that already hates and despises God. Let's get there. Let's be honest about who we are. Let's be honest about what we've done. Let's take things and run up him, ask for forgiveness and full repentance, and get out there and do the work. Well, thank you again, everyone, for listening. Please, you get a chance to do a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice. Helps with the ratings there. It helps find more people. Feel free to share the show with your friends and family members. If you're interested in my own fiction writing, you can find my work at starvingwritersguild.com or on Amazon by searching for the name MC Ashley. If you're all interested in some further solid studies into the Bible and its teachings, then check out the other members of the Anathema Ministries podcasting network. You can find me specifically on Systematic Ecology, Why I Don't Like, Friday Night Frights, Body Swing Bys, and Some Joyful Noises. Contact me at letnothingbeviewpodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Joshua Noel for the editing that he does and for the music he has to the podcast. And with all that in mind, God bless you on accordance to his will and not mine. Allow me one more time to remind you, let nothing move you.